So let's talk about, Barry, part 8 we have here, write for easy reading. Why is writing for easy reading important today?
Well, we know that we hear a lot about advertising clutter, that all media is bombarding the poor consumer. And by consumer, I'm talking about business person too, of course. Television, radio, direct mail, magazine ads, newspaper ads, coupon booklets, on and on it goes. So many critics say, well, nobody has time to read advertising. There's just too much of it. And the fact is that people in general will not pay attention to most advertising. They will pay attention to advertising that addresses their needs, that speaks the message of the prospect, what's in it for them. However, if the advertisement is written in a dull and boring way, if it's written like a college textbook that's difficult to read, unpleasant, people are going to quickly put it aside and move on. They're not willing to strain and struggle to read the message that somebody has paid for them to be presented in front of them. So it's very important to avoid obstacles to easy readership. Easy readership really means the use of short, everyday words, although words with punch are very good, but it means avoiding long, multisyllabic words, long, ponderous sentences, long, gray paragraphs, not broken up with crossheads, which are, in effect, miniature headlines. So basically, if you want people to read the messages you're paying for, you've got to make it easy and inviting for them to read, not direct obstacles for them to jump over.
What do they say the average education of the average American is? Are we talking about reading for the masses, right?
Sure. Well, even for the masses, but even the MBA graduate that's reading advertising, he or she are deluged with reading material, and they do not want to read dry, dull, difficult, hard-to-read material.
Here's something in that chapter, 7 vitally important rules, writing for easy reading. One says, start with a bang and involve the reader.
Right.
2, be enthusiastic, use short words and sentences. 3, be direct. So in this course, it really gives you all the rules right here on exactly how to do it.
Now, be direct, writing in the second person present tense. For example, that's talking about you. In contrast, I think we mentioned earlier in the interview, Macy's, when they're writing ads for women, they don't write much copy, but they're addressing her directly. When they're writing for men, they talk about him as a third party. In other words, even if it's men's suits or men's jacket, they're assuming, apparently, that the man is not reading it, but it's for some woman writing about him.
Right.
Which is ludicrous.
Part 9, communicating through layout in type.
Right.
Is this being done very poorly in today's newspapers?
Oh, yes. And magazines, and often in direct mail as well. You know, the whole purpose for advertising that is intended to generate sales, to generate leads, to generate store traffic, is to sell. It's not to create a lovely, pretty picture. So the purpose of the layout really is to enhance the words, the selling copy, the selling message. Too often, however, layout and graphics do exactly the opposite. They will oftentimes obscure the words that somebody has paid a lot of money to get a good copywriter to write. We see that increasingly as a problem as more and more people in the advertising business have mastered some computer skills, Photoshop and other graphic software programs, and the people that have done that have grown like fungus. They have no understanding, in many cases, of the purpose of the layout. What is the layout intended to do? So they will erect all kinds of graphic devices that they feel are pretty or dramatic and appeal to them, but that blot out and obscure the sales message, thereby diminishing the readership of the ad. And, of course, if you diminish readership, you flash results.
Let me ask you this. Do you think you're better off with no layout or no graphic or no photo than one?
Absolutely not. Research shows that a photograph or an illustration in an ad is viewed at least misleadingly by virtually everybody leafing through the newspaper or the pages of a magazine. The illustration communicates a message in a mere fraction of a second, and the brain says, yeah, this looks interesting, I'll look into this, or it has no interest at all and they move on. So the right illustration can be a huge asset in capturing the attention of the prospect, the logical reader for that ad. However, if the illustration is irrelevant, then it may capture fleetingly the attention of the wrong prospect, but miss capturing the attention of the one the ad is directed toward.
How about people who use illustrations to trick the reader to stop in an ad has nothing to do with the illustration? How do people respond to that?
Well, that's just the kind of person I was talking about. As soon as they realize it's not for them, they move on. Meanwhile, the ad that it wants to attract never even started to read the ad anyway, because the illustration didn't grab them by the shoulder and say, hey, this is of interest to you.
So if we were to compare an ad with an illustration that is unrelated to the advertisement and the product, comparing having that or no illustration at all, what would you choose?
Well, you're giving me a choice like, have you stopped beating your wife? I would work to get a good illustration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's always an exception to every rule, and that's why it's important to know the rules before you set out to break them. In some kinds of ads, advertorials for existence, you don't need always to have an illustration. Sometimes the headline, if it's set in big enough type, becomes the illustration. In some very small ads where space is extremely limited. I think we mentioned earlier in the interview particular ads that are appealing to a narrow segment of the market, like somebody with a backache. You run the word backache in 48-point extra bold type, which takes up two columns of a two-column ad. Well, that headline set that way, that itself is an illustration that selects the target audience for that message.
We talked earlier in the interview about your father's rival when he would give these seminars. And do you remember his name? And was there anything that he was saying that your father agreed with? Because it reminds me of when I would study Albert Lasker and Claude Hopkins in the earlier days, when they were so set on copy was the thing that was doing the selling job. But later he changed his opinion on that and found that illustrations did help improve the selling of his advertising.
Right. Yeah, they were sometimes on the same platform at meetings, for example, sponsored by associations. My dad's seminars were basically, he was the show. But the other person, a very fine and respected practitioner for many, many years, and also an early inductee into the Retail Advertising Hall of Fame, was M. Seklemian. His clients were primarily large department stores all over the world, and he was trained as an artist and a darn good one, by the way, and his emphasis was primarily on the graphics in the ad. A lot of white space, very compelling, attention-getting, relevant graphics. Generally, a minimal amount of copy. Sometimes he would grow discouraged as he looked out and saw just a sea wave of ugly advertising. But my father, as I mentioned earlier, when he had become advertising manager of Marshall Fields, sought out the absolutely best illustrators in the country to illustrate those ads. So there wasn't that big a difference overall. I think the main difference was that SEC operated primarily from talent and artistic background and his own personal experience, which is the way most advertising practitioners do work, by the way. Clyde, in addition to having talent and experience, was a lifelong student of advertising, constantly reading and studying, constantly taking advantage of the opportunities to do A-B split-run tests before and after, and to continually try to isolate those principles and ingredients that seem to be universal contributors to advertising that consistently produce maximum response. And he continued to develop and refine and hone all of that information and material into a system that incorporated graphics and copy and of course, strategy. So I think that was really the main difference between them. And as I said earlier, in their later years, they became extremely close and fast friends.
Right. How about some tips on type styles, readability of types? What are some of the mistakes advertisers are doing with the type in relationship to the types and the size and the indexes, and any tips on that?
That's extremely, extremely important, Michael. We use the expression type talks. And by that, we mean it has to communicate. Oftentimes, graphic designers, in a strong desire to be quote-unquote different, will select a trendy type style for a headline or even for the body copy that is in vogue at the moment, but that greatly handicaps the readership. And again, the whole purpose of type is to be easy to read, to make it effortless to communicate. You ask about type styles and so on. Generally, for a headline, an advertiser can use either a serif or a sans serif type when there are comparatively few words. A sans serif is fine. For body copy, a serif type, such as Times or Garamond or something like that, that has the serifs, greatly facilitates readership. A lot of copy in a sans serif type, like Arial or Helvetica or something like that, you tend to lose your place. Studies show you lose readership if you run body copy in a sans serif type.
So if I have a website, or if I'm writing a long copy sales letter or page, you think is a general rule I'm better off with Times rather than Arial?
In print, by all means. Now, on a website, that's not true. On a website, often Arial or a good, clear sans serif type is easier to read. One of the reasons is that the resolution on the screen is not as clear as black on white in the magazine or newspaper.
I see.
Or direct mail piece. So a sans serif type, like Arial, can be very effective and easy to read in comparison on the screen, particularly as the type gets smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's important, whether it's on the internet or in a direct mail piece or a print ad, is to avoid printing type of any kind over a background that obscures it and makes it difficult to read. For instance, the very last thing you want to do is print black type over a gray background. Research shows that black on white or black on yellow or a light cream are the easiest to read.
Which one's easier, light cream or white? Do you know?
I think basically white is number one and yellow is number two.
Okay.
Another thing to be avoided, particularly in body copy, is reverse type. White type out of black or out of a color background, which cuts down readership by about a third. And yet graphic designers seem to be enthralled by large chunks of black or colored blocks, and they seem to view the type as just something that they're required by their jobs to get in.
How about just for a headline of an ad where it's black with a white reverse and then the rest is...
That can be fine, particularly if it's not a long headline.
How about any advice on Courier, the old typewriter fonts?
Yeah, Courier, in a direct mail piece, a letter, the closer it can look to typewritten type, the more it gives the impression that it's written personally, that it's personal, it is easy to read. Courier also can work on a website if the type is big enough and broken up with crossheads.
What size is big enough? 12 point? 10 point?
That's difficult to say on the website because it depends on how the reader has the screen. Of course, if it comes too big, the viewer can always click, make it smaller. But the main thing is when the site is being designed for the difficult screen, it should be very easy to read without squinting.
Any other interesting facts about type that you want to share about this subject?
Well, certain of the types that graphic designers like to use have very round, like the O's are very round, then a C and a D and a B all almost look interchangeable. So if that's fairly small and the reader is trying to read in a hurry, it's sometimes confusing as to what the letters actually are. And anything that slows down the reader is likely to cost the advertiser readership of that ad because people just will not struggle to read advertising copy. If it becomes difficult, hey, there's too much to read in this publication, they turn the page.
Barry, can you talk a little bit about layout? Is there anything on layout that's important to know?
Very much so.
What does layout mean?
The layout is basically the graphic plan, the roadmap that the elements of the ad arrange by gradation and sequence to encourage readership. They basically intend to take the reader from attention right on through the ad, right down to the ordering or the place where they act. So readership shows that the illustration normally catches the eye first. If the brain, in a splash of a second, says, yeah, I'm interested in this, people will read the headline. And if the headline sets the hook, then they'll say, yeah, I'm interested, and begin to read the body copy. So there's a logical sequence that people are accustomed to reading. Many graphic designers, in an attempt to be a little different, will start out by putting the type at the top and the picture down below. Well, that cuts readership of that ad by about 50%. People look at the big picture and then turn the page. We're not taught to read from bottom to top. It's just the other way around. So any devices that interfere with readership should be avoided if you want people to read the selling message.
So a picture should always be at the top of the ad over the headline for better readership.
Let's put it this way. It should almost always be at the top of the ad. Sometimes, depending on the size of the picture, the size of the type, it can be alongside a headline. In some cases, it can be just below a headline if the picture is smaller and the headline is very large and bold. But generally, starting with the illustration at the top, so it's the first thing seen, and then the headline is the next thing, would be the way to go. Now, in some ads, a little larger, sometimes the picture and the headline can be taken in one glance. In the course, there are examples showing different ways to lay out an ad for easy readership.
How about a sub-headline? Is that part of the easy readership pattern?
Yes, a caption. Again, readership shows that the caption under an illustration has higher readership than body copy. So if the picture has gotten the attention, if you can use three or four lines of a caption to explain the illustration or to convey the main message of that ad, that's a very wise thing to do.
Part 12 discusses follow-through. Can we talk about what we're going to learn in the course under Part 12 for follow-through?
Sure, and that's a very important consideration. The examples in there is primarily how a retail store prepared for a major event, the advertising that they used, and then how they followed through in the store to fully capitalize on the advertising. It's very common, sadly, to walk into a store and say, I'd like to see the so-and-so that was advertised. And salesperson say, huh? They don't know what was advertised. Stores often do a miserable job of informing their own salespeople about what is on special, what it is that's drawing the people into the store. Let me give an example that sort of illustrates how this might work. Some years ago, when we had a monthly creative service sold to one furniture store in the city, I was calling on the general manager of a very important business, and he was just absolutely enthralled with the service and was on the verge of buying it. He really wanted to buy it, but as a good manager, he wanted to bring his sales manager in and get his opinion. So he brought the sales manager in, and the sales manager just didn't seem enthusiastic. Didn't say no, but general manager said, well, Joe, you don't seem very enthusiastic about this. Don't you agree that these ads are stronger than we're running or that we could run ourselves? The salesman says, oh, yeah, no doubt about that. Well, then what in the world would be your objection to getting this and putting it to work? The sales manager said, well, if we run ads like that and people read them and come in, he says, our customers are going to know more about our merchandise than our own salespeople.
That's funny.
And, of course, the point is that the ad should be strong enough to sell, and the salespeople should be informed about the ads, should read the copy, not only so they know what's being advertised, but because they'll pick up good selling ideas that they can use in their personal sales presentations. I can go talking on the retail level, but it applies on other levels as well. If a store is willing to spend money for an advertisement in a newspaper circulated over an area of 5-10 miles or more in the hopes of bringing somebody in, you would think that same message would be worth circulating to the people walking by right in front of the store, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And yet you seldom, if ever, see the advertiser having a blow-up of the ad in the window or right where it can be seen by passers-by. That would cost maybe $10 to do and reach, perhaps, depending on location, scores to hundreds of people a day carrying the same message where they can just turn or walk right in. The same message you're spending to try to get people to get up off their sofas and into their car and downtown and into the shopping center and park and get into the store. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's commonplace. A department store. Well, just about any kind of a retailer. A jewelry store. In effect, let's just take it now to, say, somebody in a business in the service business. A carpet cleaner, for example. A carpet cleaner typically comes in, does a nice job, gets a check, thank you very much, goodbye. From my experience and that of a good many friends, the typical carpet cleaner never sends a follow-up mailing. Say it's been 6 months since we cleaned your house. It's time to get your carpets cleaned again. You've got a lot more dust and dirt and mites and all that kind of stuff in there. If you call in the next 2 weeks, here's our special offer. That doesn't happen. No follow-through. Another very inexpensive, almost free way to follow through for any kind of business that serves the consumer in the home, whether it's a carpet cleaner or an appliance repair person or whatever, in the case of a carpet cleaner, to attach a little sticker to the handle of the vacuum cleaner in the house with their name and phone number.
It's a great idea.
Or for the appliance service repair person to attach a sticker to the control panel of the washing machine. It's just a matter of thinking, what we call total selling. How am I going to get the absolute maximum value out of having made contact with this customer or client, as the case may be? And the answer is, it's important to look at all possible ways to follow through. Now, in the business-to-business arena, oftentimes people will spend a lot of money, companies will, on a large, expensive exhibit booth. They'll spend money to have their sales staff attending that booth, hotel expenses and so on. They'll have a fishbowl out there, they'll collect business cards, and then basically fail to follow through. Very expensive when they spend money to get a lead but don't follow it up. Same thing in business-to-business advertising in trade journals. They will manufacture, will run an ad, they'll get a lead. Weeks go by, the inquirer has never received the literature. And often when they do receive the literature, all it is a brochure and an envelope with no sales letter and no kind of personalization. It's crazy. And then when you're talking about people like ourselves that are in the information business, and presumably a lot of your people that are subscribers to your news list, understand the importance of the back end, of capturing the name, and then continuing to do everything possible through follow-up mailings or emails or whatever is appropriate, as the case may be, to try to get them to the website, to try to get the order, close the sale. Or if it's lead generation, well, and that would be the case in lead generation. And then once you have the customer or the client, then you want to continually develop products that they can be sold to, so they can be sold again and again and again. It's an awful lot more, costs a lot more money to get that client the first time than to sell them repeatedly with attractive offers after they've already become a satisfied client. All of that would fall under the category of follow-through.
Here we have part 13, standard rules, minimum checklists, and how to use them. What's this about?
This chapter here is probably worth $1,000 conservatively just on its own right, because it contains virtually the sum total of all of the research into what makes advertising sell and how to go about constructing an advertisement based on access to tens of millions of dollars of response-tested advertising and case study before and afters and all other kinds of advertising research. So there it is, all in a very concise, logical order, from how you start your planning before you even think about writing the ad, right on through to every element of strategy and graphics and layout, copy, right down to the action.
So this is the actual summary of the entire system, basically.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And how about the last part, conclusion, self-tester, and then we've talked a little bit about the index.
Yeah. This takes the principles that have been illustrated throughout the course with a great many retail ads and expands it and includes a great many national ads, showing how the same principles work for all categories of businesses, regardless of whatever industry they're in. Then there is also bound in a self-test, which reviews each of the 15 lessons. It affords the student that is really serious about mastering this material an opportunity to go through it, fill in answers to the questions, and see how much of it they have really gotten and mastered, or where they maybe need to go back and restudy it a little bit.
Is there also a small section on classified advertising in here?
There really is. And incidentally, that's a very important type of advertising for a great many businesses. Some businesses get started just by running classified ads. Other businesses, for instance, I've had major furniture accounts that ran television, radio, print advertising, but also regularly use classifieds to generate at very low cost traffic to buy odds and ends, closeouts, and things like that. This does tell how to use these principles and boil them down into effective classified ads. When we're talking about improving your advertising, we're really talking about real money. Too many advertisers think of paying advertising bills as simply writing out a check to the media at the end of the month. Whereas, if they had to think of it in terms of reaching into their wallet or going to their cash register, it's the message that gives the value to that piece of paper. And the same thing is true in advertising, whether you're buying space in a magazine or a newspaper, or whether you're buying the space in a direct mail piece. It's the message that gives it the value. And it's up to the advertiser that is serious about maximizing profits to learn how to evaluate and create $100 messages time after time after time. And that's what this program teaches in depth.
Okay, wonderful. That's a great illustration. Let's do some question and answers from some of my students. The first question I want to ask you is, you know, your father put this course together before the internet was even around, and you have a lot of interested copywriting students and advertisers who are using the internet as a medium to sell products and services. Can this course help me with advertising and selling on the internet? Is it all interchangeable?
Yes, it is enormous help to anybody selling on the internet. And that's why, despite the fact this was published back in the 60s, we're selling probably more copies today to internet entrepreneurs than to any other category of business. And that's because people putting up websites, certainly the kind of people that are members of your list, are interested in selling things, not just having an image website. They soon realize that if they don't have darn good selling copy that communicates a powerful selling message, their site is not going to produce click now on the order form. So they're motivated to learn how to write compelling selling messages. This is certainly a prime source in an organized way to learn how to write selling messages regardless of what product or service you're selling.
Okay. Here's a question from Alvin Tan of Manila. Hi, Michael. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to ask questions and listen to experts in the copywriting industry. Barry, how does an untested rookie advertiser or copywriter gain the confidence and, more importantly, the credibility to approach paying clients?
I take it this is somebody that wants to maybe start out as a freelance copywriter.
Right.
Well, the first thing that I would suggest is that he convince himself through study that he understands the principles. Next, I would suggest that he take a typical ad, and heaven knows in Manila, like in all major cities, the newspaper there, I'm not sure if it's the Manila Times, but the major daily newspaper, their local magazines, and to select some ads in categories that he's particularly interested in or where he feels he has a background that he would like to work in that industry, take their ads and take a couple of them and revamp them. So if the graphic elements are good, make copies, use the same essential graphic elements, but set up an ad, write an ad, and typeset it so it's like a before and after. And then make an appointment with the owner of that business and go in and say that he's a student of the advertising masters that are concerned only with getting results. And based on his studies, the advertising that the company had been running, although attractive and no doubt as effective as anybody else's, his research has led him to believe that this type of advertising would produce better results for the same advertising cost, and get into a discussion like that and ask if the advertiser would like to try this ad as a test. He may find it a good idea to let him test one without charge, or he can say, if my ad outpulls the other, pay me so much and let me continue to create your ads. The main thing is to demonstrate that he is a student of advertising. And quite frankly, anybody that has mastered this course will be able to talk more intelligently about response advertising than any media representative or any advertising agency representative in the city. Then, of course, he wants to begin to collect actual before and after results and case histories and get testimonials, and he'll be on his way.
Very good. Here's a question from Nadar Anis. Some copywriters suggest revealing the offer in the beginning of a sales letter or ad, especially if it's very powerful or has a strong guarantee. Do you recommend that? And if so, when is that a good idea?
Excellent question. In an ad, often the offer is the main reason that you are running that ad. In a retail, for example, you always want to have the offer, which would include the price, right up there as part of or an adjacent to the picture and the headline. In direct mail, if you're selling a $500 course or something like that, you don't want to start out telling them, here's a $500 course right in the headline. What you want to do is really write an incredible headline and subhead, maybe a couple of subheads, and talk about the benefits that they're going to get if they read this letter and obtain the product and then sell the product, and really not reveal the price and the terms until the person is pretty well sold that that's what they want. In other words, that would come near the close and near the bid for action, talking about the price and the bonuses and if they're offering split payments and things of that type.
Okay. Barry, what was the most successful direct mail campaign in which you were involved? In your opinion, what contributed to its success and why was it successful? What steps did you take in creating it? Bob Porosky.
I've been fortunate to have had a number of pretty successful direct mail campaigns, but the first one, I think, was back when I was in the mail order business. It was my second job out of college in Chicago. I worked with this mail order company, Precision Equipment Company, and they sold industrial equipment by mail, mostly drop shipped, all over the United States. The owner of the business, Walter Hybe, who was a brilliant guy, he was a high school math teacher that started the business literally on his kitchen table. And when I joined him, it was a multi-million-dollar business. He realized that getting customers the first time was important, but once you had customers, the follow-up mailings, the back end, was really the sweet spot. So, understandably, he wanted to find a way to rapidly increase his customer list, his client list. Then he would send to those people his catalog more frequently. So we devised a plan. We were going to test out mailing jumbo postcards, each one with one product at an incredibly attractive offer. We had a series of four of those, and over a seven-month period, we mailed out these jumbo postcards, all of them asking, these are not lead generation. Each of them had a cutout coupon and asked for payment, or the extension of credit, which mailing to businesses was a common way to do it, but asked for a specific order. In 7 months, we doubled the customer list that he had developed over the previous 9 years. So that really gave me a taste of how satisfying it is from a creative person's point of view to see your efforts and your words generate piles and piles of orders and accomplish a really major objective. More recently, ongoing, a very simple one-page letter that was originally written for furniture stores has since been adapted for other types of retail businesses and service businesses, would be what we call a preferred customer letter or a client reactivation letter. Simply one page, black ink on white paper, 50 cents in the mail, first class, that has consistently brought returns of from $8 to as much as $17.13 per letter mailed out.
Wow.
To customers. I don't know of any legal way to print money much faster than that.
Wow, that's incredible.
And that has been used by several hundred businesses all over the planet and continues to be used as we speak.
Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. This is the end of part 4. Please continue to part 5.